ladies and gentlemen. How do you do? My name is Jack, and with me always is Rylan, Zach, Andrew, and Alex. Tonight, we bear witness to one of the last completed films by the legendary Orson Welles in his lifetime, F for Fake. Recently, though, the film The Other Side of the Wind, which was Orson Welles' last uncompleted film, was finally completed and released on Netflix in 2018. The two films were actually filmed simultaneously, but F for Fake was finished, and The Other Side of the Wind couldn't complete editing process, so it remained dormant for years, dealing with the Welles estate, lawsuits, all that crap. But tonight, we're talking about the film that he did finish, which is, again, titled F for Fake. Released in 1974, the film stars Orson Welles, Oya Kodar, Elmire Dahori, and Clifford Irving. Not as actors, but as themselves, sort of. The film focuses on a career art forger, Elmire Dahori, famous for making copies of famous artists' work, such as Picasso. The film also explores the notions of authorship and authenticity, and the value of art in general. The film is a compilation of footage originally shot by, I'm going to butcher this name, Francois Reichenbach, and the new footage shot by Orson Welles and Oya Kodar. Actually, those two were dating at the time. They're sort of like mistresses, like secret lovers, because Orson Welles was married to someone else at the time. And actually, Oya is the head of the Welles estate. The film, again, has a Rotten Tomatoes rating of 89% with the critical consensus. F for Fake playfully poses intriguing questions while proving that even Orson Welles' minor works contain their share of masterful moments. With an IMDb rating of 7.8, the initial responses from critics, though at the time, were polarizing, with many stating that the film was an incoherent arthouse mess. I would believe some would say that today. However, most today consider the film to be lauded for its editing techniques and considered to be one of the first feature-length film essays. And that's... My little history with the film was that, of course, I'm like most cinephiles, you become fascinated and interested by Orson Welles. You know, he has, you know, the distinction of having the greatest film ever made, you know, or at least that's what's continuously told with Citizen Kane, and his other works too are just as lauded, you know, like the Magnificent Ambersons, Touch of Evil, The Trial, and many others. F for Fake was always drawn to me because it was his last film, and it was so weird because it was like this simple, very low budget, just obscure film, just like, what is this really about? And I always had to watch like the first like 5 or 10 minutes of the movie because it was like, it does kind of draw you in, like, where is this going? What is this? And for the longest time, I just never got around to watching the whole thing. And then finally I did. And I was kind of surprised how drawn in I was for its initial like topic of like art forgery and art in general, the art market. I have no interest in that whatsoever, at least at the time I didn't. And then as the film progressed, and as you all saw, it's not really that. It's kind of like talking about the whole idea of art in general, like who values are, why is art important to some people, why is this considered a fake, you know, the whole ideal of like, you know, artists wanting credit, but really, you know, as the film shows, that, you know, the whole notion of owning authorship is almost kind of like a fool's hope, you know, because eventually it's going to fade away. You know, there's this one scene in this movie which I think is outstanding, where Orson does a monologue about this church that has no known signature, as he put it, and yet we still marvel at it as this great, you know, gift from mankind throughout the centuries. And there's many other examples of that, and there's also been examples of great art that has disappeared or been destroyed and it's gone. You know, recently we had the fire of Notre Dame, and the risk of losing, you know, centuries of history just in a blink of an eye. And just, you know, it brings up a lot of great discussions, great ideas, and someone who loves art and not even just like painting, but writing and filmmaking. Or the Orson goes into his own upbringing with, you know, how he fooled people with the War of the Worlds radio show, which I'm fascinated with. and also with his career as well, and, you know, going back and forth and all that. And I really enjoyed it once I finally got around to sitting through the whole thing, and I loved the payoff at the end too, just pulls the rug out of under your feet. And yeah, no, I think this is a fascinating movie. It's definitely not for everyone, because it is an art house movie, and not everyone likes art house movies, which is perfectly fine. But I am, regardless of how people think of it, I feel like someone can take away from something from this movie. So I'm very curious about all your guys' opinions, whether, you know, how it goes or not. But I want to immediately go to my left and discuss with Rylan. Rylan, what is your take on this film, F or Fake?
My take on the fakes?
Yeah.
Still trying to figure that out, honestly. I think y'all aren't going to be hearing a lot from me this episode, I don't think, because I'm not really sure what I just watched or what I'm supposed to get out of it. Do I poo-poo it as art house trash? No. I think it does raise a couple of good pondering points. Like you're saying, the authorship, ownership of art, or and its relation to how it impacts the artist and or rather the creators and society around it. Also the quote that keeps coming up a few times throughout, it's pretty, but is it art? I've given that one a think, but yeah, so far, I mean, I'm more interested in listening, I think, rather than talking, because I'm still trying to digest this one and trying to pull something coherent out of it, because I would be lying if I say that I have a clear understanding of what it was trying to say.
Mm-hmm. I think like the overall theme is kind of like it's the thread line throughout the whole movie. You know, what is art? And one of the things I love about this movie is it kind of really puts into question, you know, the expert, the one who defines what art is, because if you really do a lot of research into the art world, the art market, and you just see like how lucrative it is and how these certain individuals can make, say, that painting is worth this much money, and yet, you know, it could be completely worthless by someone else. And another thing is just how much what money goes into it is that a lot of it uses it as a money laundering scheme. Mm-hmm. You know, hey, we got a gangster or, you know, criminals, just got a lot of money and they have to put it away somewhere, so they'll put it into an art, a gallery, you know, private art gallery with someone who doesn't mind taking the money. He almost acts like a bank in a sense.
Well, then the notion of art dealers encouraging essentially the forgers in this movie. They kind of they kind of play with that idea a few times.
Yeah,
and it's really you kind of think about it, and it just comes down to like cultivating demand.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh well, now we got this demand, so now we got to deliver.
Yeah, and they even say that, like, they say it blanks, like, if there wasn't a market, there wouldn't be any fakers. You know, there is a demand for it, and people will want it, and they even humanize in a way, make it like, hey, some people are starving, they want food, and their original work won't get by. And we've seen time and time again of movies. There was one that just recently came out with Melissa McCarthy, where she does the fake writings.
Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Yeah, Can You Ever Forgive Me? And that's pretty much the Clifford Irving story as well. Mm-hmm. And actually, there's a movie about Clifford Irving that came out, I think, a decade ago called The Hoax, with Richard Gere playing Clifford Irving. And it dramatizes the whole thing of him, hey, I got the Howard Hughes story. And it just kind of does an actual film about his story. I don't know if the movie goes into the Elmire part of his life, but because I haven't seen the movie, because I heard it was eh. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to move on to Zachariah. Now, you had seen this prior, because I had recommended it to you. Yeah. I was like, you need to see this. And on second time, what'd you think?
Yeah, so this movie is really cool. And it's a film that, yeah, definitely you should see multiple times. The thing about this movie is that it's just rapid fire. It's giving you tons of information. and going all over the place and kind of jumping between different people, different fakers, if you will, throughout the whole thing, while being a gigantic magic trick, mm-hmm. really the whole time. So it's really fascinating. I remember when you told me, like, oh, you got to watch this movie and stuff, and I literally watched it that night. Like, it was super late. I must have watched it, like, 4 a.m. or something is when I started it. And it was just, like, it's so hypnotic, especially with Orson Welles narrating.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of draws you in from the very start. And just the format and everything that he's using, like, with the cameraman in plain sight and, like, the actress at the beginning, and he's doing magic tricks and stuff, and he lays out that, like, whole thing which comes to bite you at the end and stuff like that because you're not paying attention to the runtime because you get so hypnotized by, you know, the facts of the stories and things like that and the way he's telling it. And there's just so much to kind of draw you in that by the time that reveal comes up later that, like, the last 17 minutes or whatever mm-hmm. he's been lying, it's pretty dope.
Yeah.
It's just a cool movie. I mean, and yeah, and like you were saying too, it's not really about a subject that I would normally care about. It's about, like, art fakery and stuff like that. But then it's when you go down deeper into it, you know, what he's talking about, like, what is art and what's really an expert on art, because a lot of the times, like, they're disproven with, like, you know, like a fakery or something like that. They get sold, mm-hmm. but they should be an expert. They should know better. And yada yada, and it goes on even past that, and it's, yeah, it's just really fascinating. It's a pretty cool movie.
Yeah, no, it's, and like I said, this is like the third time I've sat through it in its entirety, and I'm still like, there are parts that just I'm looking forward to seeing again, because it mm-hmm. just, it just sucks in. Like, I bring up the church scene quite a bit, because I just, it does kind of, that, if you want to know what the whole movie is about, and that's actually the hour mark when
yeah.
that church scene goes, and then everything after that is
bullshit. Yeah.
So it's a nice cap to at least their first hour of basic fact, or say, but
yeah.
even within them talking facts, they were talking about a lot of fakes, a lot of lies, and just there's layers upon layer, and
yeah.
just the hypocrisy, and just it's a rabbit hole that, you know, everyone can get sucked into very easily. And
mm-hmm.
I'll make a little note about this movie too, is that when actually I should say the initial box office was not good.
Yeah.
It only made like $180,000 in this initial box office, and I think it was only released in France theatrically at the time. But when it was trying to get some US distribution, Welles made a trailer, a 9-minute trailer for this movie that used no footage from said movie. He made a completely separate F for fake trailer using brand new stuff. And
that's
yeah,
that's
funny.
Kind of brilliant, actually.
Yeah, apart from some, you know, brief split screens, camera shots, the entire film is like a self-contained short containing original material starring Welles, Oya, and a bunch of others. And you can watch it on the Criterion Channel as well. It's its own thing. But I think U.S. distributors saw it, and they were like, yeah, we're not having this movie, because it looked so insane. And I just even found out he made a fake trailer for his movie. So even that, I thought it was like, that's cool.
Yeah.
Andrew, we're gonna move on to you. I am curious what your take is on this piece of fakery. Go on. Okay, Kitty.
Yeah, it's very art house film. I can tell. I knew what I was in for pretty much right away. Like the type of film it was going to be, because it sets itself up pretty quickly. Like it's going to be fast paced. It's going to go at lightning speed, because it just starts that way. Like you don't even have a time to take a breath right at the beginning. Like it literally just starts. And I mean, he tells you straight up right at the beginning what you're in for. So yeah, it feels like it's I feel like you could just get a lot out of it, like you were saying, by just rewatching it. Every time you watch it, you probably pick up on something that you hadn't before, just because it comes at you so quickly. But yeah, it's not a, like you guys have been saying, it's not a topic I'm particularly interested in. I have been in the past with some other films that have addressed it before. Like I I did watch Exit Through the Gift Shop, right? And that covered,
I was gonna mention that.
Yeah, that covered the Banksy and that whole, like, that covered art forgery document, like a, not an art house documentary, like a straight documentary. So I'm familiar with the topic and kind of those themes, having been a film addressing those issues. So this was kind of an interesting way to tackle it, just because the way he was doing it was, well, it wasn't as straight as something like that, where it's just like giving you facts, telling you, hey, this is what happened, isn't this crazy. It's more, he adds his own flair to it, right? It's, the line, the fake part at the end, there's that, and just the way it was a shot, it's just so all over the place that for me personally, I was questioning whether he was bullshitting the whole, like, whether he's bullshitting during, like, is he actually telling the truth? Like, I don't know if it's, I was questioning the whole time if this is actually true or not, just because the way he filmed it, it just seems like he could be lying at any point, right? Like, I was like, I don't know, man. I can't, oh yeah, okay, I remember, oh, he's talking about himself, that's real, I know that stuff. I don't know much about these two guys, like, I don't know much about Irving or Elmir. So, like, I don't know where he's getting this footage from or whatever. Like, because I'm not familiar, I was questioning it most of the way through. But at the same time, I'm like, oh, there are things that would come up where it'd be like, oh, this might actually be real. And then at the end, it just got crazy. I was like, oh, this must be fake, right? Because, and then I've forgotten that, like,
that's what happens.
Hour mark, right? Because I was like, this is fucking ridiculous. Picasso.
Yeah.
Like, wait, Picasso, oh yeah, that doesn't make sense. Like, that wouldn't make sense, right? Like, I was trying to think in my head, I'm like, am I crazy? Like, what time do, what year, like, what
year is it?
Yeah, like, what the fuck, right? And then I was like, oh, okay, I forgot.
Because, like,
made up some crazy bullshit at the end. Okay.
Because, like, right at the start of the movie, it's just like, this is a movie about trickery, about fraud, about lies.
Yeah.
And then, by the way, everything I would tell you for the next hour is going to be the truth. And, like, is it, though?
Yeah, right?
And then even he opens, like, why not? I'm a charlatan.
Yeah, you know, like, he keeps saying that shit. And I'm like,
he's a magician. He's just an actor. You know, like, he flat out just sets you up. So you're always kind
of
like.
I also don't know any of this backstory. Like, I'm not that familiar with Orson Welles. So even when he's talking about shit, like, oh, I was a painter. I went to Ireland, and I, you know, I tried to. I had a donkey, and I tried to. And I was like, did he? What? I was like, do you got a, like, wiki this later? Like, did this actually have, like, I don't fucking know. I just watched Citizen Kane like a month or 2 months ago. So
that's,
like,
right. Oh yeah.
What do I know, right?
Not exactly an expert.
So I'm not an
Orson Welles. But what is an expert?
yeah.
Exactly. But I do think that it is it poses some interesting questions in regards to the value of art and whether it's where does its value come from? I do think he made some interesting observations in regards to what he was telling. I can't remember if it was, I think it was like Elmir was telling the story. And again, these are people who, like, lie a whole bunch. So you don't know what's true, what's not true.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. As saying, like, what was it, Picasso or somebody looking at their own paintings and then believing that they were that they had drawn them, but they were fakes, that kind of thing. And I'm like, I could believe that. Like, people, like, forgeries at the question of, is if a forgery is good enough, does it become legitimized? Like, is it legitimized? And I think that's an interesting perspective as well, just because, like, if it's that good, does it have value? Like, because it must be good to fool people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, if you had a fake, if you owned a fake, would it matter if it looked that good, right? Would you knowing take away from that? And so it's just these questions that make these observations that I think are interesting. But again, it's not like my favorite topic, right? So
indeed. And yeah. And it's, what's funny is that before I had seen F for Fake, I had worked, I did a videographer gig at an art gallery where the video was introducing like this new 3D scanner technique that authenticated art. And down to like where they did like a, it almost looked like a 3D map of like a mountain, because they got so close to the, that they cannot see, yeah. Oh, these are the bumps and this is 100% real. And they were trying to promote it as like, this should be revolutionized, making sure we don't have any fakes and all that. And they actually sold Picasso's and they have Salvador Dali statues and all that. So it's, I kind of almost got a little bit of an education prior to seeing this movie, but it was one of those things where it's like, I wasn't fully paying attention because it was like, for me, I had no idea.
Yeah.
And then another thing about this, one thing that they mentioned in this movie that I think is a real good point is they mentioned how old famous artists like Michelangelo used to do fakes himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he almost used to be like, for to become a true master, you had to show that you could duplicate another master's work perfectly.
Yeah.
And that's how they used to sell statues. And if you could be as good as, say, another artist, then they'll say, okay, show me what you actually can do on your own. If you can prove that you can do as good as, say, again, Michelangelo, if you can do as good as him, then that proves you're worthy. You're not just some, again, fake, which is hilarious.
It's like getting your start as a fan fiction writer.
Exactly. That's actually a great point. That's a good comparison for modern, you know, modern audiences. And then the other thing, too, is that this film is not, it's hard to call it a true documentary. Because and I think the film essay really fits this movie better because it's not, again, I think it, in terms of production, it was originally started out as a documentary about Elmir, directed by Francois Reichenbach, and then a friend of Orson. Orson came actually later, and he was a subject in it. And then once they found out about Clifford Irving, and then Orson's like, hey, we could actually do something with this. Because at the time, he was a struggling, for lack of a better word, independent filmmaker. His cameraman at the time was someone who had just got out of like school or something like that and was basically following Orson all around the world trying to shoot films that Orson wanted to do. And there's a great it's on YouTube, you can actually watch it, called like the Unfinished Works of Wells, and it just is just b-roll of oral dailies of films that he tried to get made, either star himself or whatever. And it just kind of, you know, harkens back to almost like, say, an early filmmaker's work, but he's in his 50s and 60s and he's already made his best work. So it's, and then, you know, he took the footage from this and just, you know, through editing, made something out of it. He's even a fake with this film, you know, he didn't even start it. He just like, oh, I'm gonna take this, add all of my own stuff, and there you go. But anyways, Alex, what did you think?
Threw me for a loop the first third of the movie, because as Zach was saying, the editing, the quick cuts, there's no, it seems, seemed to me at least, that after the introduction, there was no singular focus to the film because of all those cuts and the freeze frames and the music that was playing. So it distracted me, but I remembered what he said in the beginning. There's misdirection. He's a charlatan. You had mentioned about the editing, which I think for the time was great because they didn't have anything in the way of the techniques we have now for editing. Like with timelines and such, you got your video tracks. You could do three or four at one time. You could throw in pictures, and then you've got however many audio tracks you want to mix in. So you can have music and how many ever sounds you want to add. But back then, you were actually cutting film in the 70s.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So much more difficult to do.
Well, they even show the movie all of his editing bay, like, right. Yeah. He's sitting in front of it. And like, it's like, that's his office. That was like his legit office where he would cut his footage in his films that he was trying to make, such as The Other Side of the Wind.
And so he's keeping you a little bit in that mode of, don't exactly trust me. Because he's kind of showing you the process by filming himself in his editing room. And then having the camera film the smaller editing camera, which is showing footage that's in the film, and then cutting to that footage.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like you're going in and out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like you're in and out of hypnosis.
Yeah, it puts you in, like, again, like it strengthens that this is an essay. This is a theory. This is Orson Welles's essay.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can, it's all about a string of consciousness. You know, you go from this topic, and then once you're bored with it, you go to a different one when it loses steam. So that's how, like, you don't kind of get overwhelmed with just focusing on just Elmire, you know, because once his story reaches a point, then you go to Clifford Irving.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but then Clifford Irving kind of reaches a boiling point, then you go to Orson Welles and his own little autobiography. But then he goes and talks about the making of the own film himself, and that's an own story. And then there's Oya, so there's almost like six different narratives that he's basically stringing together to create an overall, you know, film, which was what we saw.
Yeah. I think it's a bit, he was doing a bit tongue-in-cheek with that as well, because he's saying that we're going to talk about this story, but in order to tell that story, it's like a Bill Cosby bit. I have to tell you that story in order to tell you this story.
Yeah.
And vice versa. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of piling it on just to say, this is kind of a joke.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's the setup for a joke.
Yeah.
I think he's seen art house films before, and he's saying, yeah, I'm not really going to do that. You know, it's kind of his light take on it. But he's still using those elements to put his own signature on a film like that.
Mm-hmm.
So after the quick cuts, I think it was a good 30 minutes in, so the second third, then it settled down a little bit into Elmire, and then the relationship between him and Clifford. And then, as you said, it moves on from one to the other, to the other, to the other.
Mm-hmm.
So the audience never gets bored. And of course not, with all that editing and stuff going on. And the audience has to keep in mind, what is fake? What is this all about?
Mm-hmm.
And when it got to the monologue part about the church, that's beautiful. That can be cut out and put on its own. As a matter of fact, I think there's something on YouTube from his last unfinished film which has that in and of itself, which is Alone.
Yeah.
It's a little standalone clip, and it's great.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this reminded me of. I'd like to say that you could take his monologue and use that as your own piece if you're going into audition for something. I'm sure many people have.
Oh,
but that's what I would do.
Oh,
That's great.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a great monologue, and it just kind of goes, like, again, like, I can just listen to Orson Welles read the dictionary.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it'd be fascinating, just because
he's hypnotizing.
He's like, extremely. Yeah. And it's just, that's always been his skill, has been able to just suck you in. Like, again, like, he flat out, and it is true, like, his story about going to Ireland as a painter and selling them, that's all true. And him getting a start on stage, that's also true, because
and him lying,
bullshitting, getting himself in, and then he even when asked, like, how did you make Citizen Kane, he would admit sheer ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea what I was doing. Mm-hmm. But because of that, talented crew around him could use that as a catalyst to try new things, because he got this kid who's has no foundation, had no idea what he's doing, but he has new ideas. He has, you know, unbound energy that we can, you know, go into and maybe make something great out of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, a good artist can recognize true talent. You know, a faker can recognize the true artist. And in a sense, that's what Welles was. He could recognize the best cameraman. You know, that's how he got him always for his movies, or good actors or writers. That's why he always quotes Shakespeare. That's why he does a lot of Shakespeare, because he knows that's, you're not getting better than that.
That's right.
Indeed. So,
yeah. When I was watching it, I always the way that I was taking it, you're saying it as like a film essay. It didn't seem that he was just speaking about, at least whenever Orson was his narration, at least whenever he was referring to art, I didn't feel like it was restricted to fine art. I felt like he was basically speaking about art in general.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Never felt like he was just saying, because like we've always talked about like, oh, this art, these paintings, these forgeries and stuff. That's just, I feel like he took the base story of forgery with Irving and Elmire, and he expanded upon it to include all types of art,
mm-hmm.
film included. So I feel like he's just speaking about art in general, not just fine art.
Oh, absolutely.
Just because he always just refers to, yeah, he always just says art. He never always just says paintings or
mm-hmm.
or fine art. He's a little more general than that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way I took it. I kept looking at it as he's just talking about all art, including films, like whether it's critique of film or things mm-hmm. like that. Where does the value lie? And
mm-hmm.
I thought it was a much, at least that's the way I took it. It was just a much mm-hmm. larger conversation. That's why I'm mm-hmm. saying, like, I don't have as that. Maybe that's it's because of this, but I don't have as much of an interest in like the art market, because
mm-hmm.
I don't really give a shit how much some idiot is going to pay for a for a painting or a fake, right? I'm
mm-hmm.
like, that doesn't matter much to me. It just, if anything, it just makes me a little sick to think that somebody who's has that much money to burn on something. So,
and I love how the image, like, of him burning the painting.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's
like, that's just the image of, it's just a wastefulness and, or, you know,
mm-hmm.
whatever. Like, I don't think, it's not something I'm that interested in, but that's why I kind of looked at it as all art.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. And him making just a comment or trying to comment on what makes art have value
mm-hmm.
in all types of art. So,
oh yeah. And like, you're absolutely right, because he brings up, of course, like his own upbringing. Like again, he was a painter as well, but he was
yeah.
also an actor. He was a filmmaker. He was a radio star.
Yeah.
I love it when they go into, cause yeah, that the whole War of the Worlds,
it was huge fakery.
Oh, it's what made him famous.
Yeah. But yet he didn't go to jail, as he said. Like, he didn't go to jail.
Some guy in
South America.
Imitate Colombia or something.
Something like that. And even the story itself about the whole War of the Worlds is even a bit like, is the extent of what happened, of the story, legit? And it's, and a lot of people say, oh, like half the country tuned into it. That's actually not true. It's only maybe like a couple million. In just the real story is that they weren't the most listened to store network at that time. It was actually another radio station, the NBC station, because the War of the Worlds was on CBS radio. And the NBC one had this ventriloquist act on their radio show who was a big popular guy, and everyone listened to that. I always find it hilarious people want to listen to a ventriloquist act. I find that hilarious. But it had been on air for about, say, 10 minutes, and then it went to commercial. Of course, people liked to channel surf at the time, and they channel surfed to CBS, who was in the middle of the War of the Worlds that didn't... And so the audience had switched, didn't hear the warning, this is a play on H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. So they came in, all of a sudden, hearing this news bulletin stuff that sounded very much like the same material as they've been hearing the Germans at the time invading or gain rumblings in Europe about the potential war.
Yeah.
So everyone was a bit on edge. And then when they started hearing stuff happening in New Jersey and all that, they were thinking it's the Germans. They got the Martians and the Germans are working together. Oh my God. And there's like kernels of truth of like of things that did happen. Yes. The town that they pinpointed in the play, in the radio play, there were some that did run for their lives because no one had experienced this before. But the whole rumors of, legends of people jumping out of buildings and all that, there's no records of anyone dying. And yet there was 12,000 newspaper articles written about this the next day, just spreading the rumor. And this was also at a time when radio and newspapers were fighting with each other for... you know, their audiences. And so newspapers were finding anything to put down the radio because the radio was taking over.
And sensationalism.
Oh, that doesn't sound familiar at all.
Oh, I know. That's why I want to, like, I've had this idea forever to do a movie on the War of the Worlds radio show because it's so topical today. It's amazing and how history repeats itself. And even that, like, his, what was supposedly, you know, this legend, even itself is shrouded with fakery and, you know, rumors and innuendo. It's fantastic. It's just, again, like, you can just find so many different layers in this story and in this movie of just, like, have like all the bullshit in it. It's fascinating.
But why do a movie about that when Spielberg already brought us the classic?
What?
War of the Worlds.
Well, there's also, of course, the 1950s one as well.
Yeah.
Like the actual, but like
the Spielberg one, the Tom Cruise.
You know, there was 3 War of the Worlds movie that came out in June of 2005.
Really?
There was the Spielberg one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there was 2, you know, knockoffs.
Oh.
That were trying to release for at of the same course. Time, but yeah. Because it's a public domain book, they could use the same title.
Right.
And there was one that was released that was I think an Asylum film.
Of course, yeah.
And then there was one that was independent that was a true adaptation, like of the time period, and it was like 3.5 hours long because it was like almost word for word of the book, but it was so low budget because you can see the fake mustaches and all that stuff. But yeah, no, it's a story that's been told. Quite over and over again, but my main thing is on the radio show, not the play, but just the whole event and how it was made and just seeing the people reacting to it and seeing the newspapers overreacting to it, and then just seeing a young, you know, because Orson was 23 years old when he did that,
yeah,
and he was 26 when he made Citizen Kane, you know, and you know he bullshit him the way up to the top, and then. I love that line. Started my way at the top and then worked my way down ever since.
Yeah.
Which it's both kind of sad because it's true.
Yeah.
It is.
You came out of the gate swinging pretty hard.
And yeah.
It's like, how do you top that? That's why it always sucks. Like those directors who make like, you know, a darn tootin' film as their first film, and then after that it's just kind of like it
downgrades to written tootin'.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then it's just
poop. Tootin' and then,
poop.
Yeah. And then
yeah.
A great line that Orson said, and actually it's the name of a documentary that was released with The Other Side of the Wind, which Orson was known to say, "They'll love me when I'm dead." Because at the time he was, you know, blacklisted from Hollywood, he was poisoned, no one wanted him. And then, of course, you know, once an artist dies, they're, you know, made deified and they're, you know, all hail the master and all that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But at the time, like, it's a sad story where he had his AFI, you know, lifetime achievement. He was awarded that and all of Hollywood was there, but he was also trying to get funding for The Other Side of the Wind. So he showed clips at the award ceremony and no one gave him a dime. And they just awarded him this lifetime achievement for all what he did for cinema, but they won't even give him a few bucks just to make his last movie or to finish his movie. And it's just fascinating, just like, you know, again, like we tend to worship artists, whether they're singers, whether they're actors, and all that, and thinking they know all, or they, you know, they're the, you know, the true masters of their craft. But yet it's once they die, it's like the art remains, and only for a certain amount of time. You know, something may be, you know, important now, but then 50 years from now, it might mean as much as, you know, this twisty tie in my hand, nothing. And it's a sobering, you know, lesson to take in at times. Rylan, you've been very quiet. I know you
as
have.
As I forewarned.
Yes, but in terms of what you've gathered a little bit, I'm more curious, like, I know there's a lot to take in, but what things did kind of stand out to you, whether it was moments or lines, or in terms of just like, you know, what was your overall take in terms of, like, what a movie was trying to say? As much as, like, you know, you're still processing it, but where are you at this point?
I mean, about the same. This isn't going to be a few minutes type of process. This is going to be a weeks and multiple viewings type of processing.
Mm-hmm.
It basically just seems to me how it's suggesting that the financial and cultural value of art in various forms. They, like Andrew said, they specifically are talking about paintings for the context of the movie, but it seems like they're alluding to all art in general. But it's essentially pointing out how its value is decided by people who arguably don't know anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
You just seem a bit bitter That's honestly, like, with the context of his like that being his last film and the and his, where his career was at that point,
yeah,
it does seem like he's making a that there's a bit of bitterness in what he's saying, right? And, mm-hmm. and the message he's trying to get across, like critics don't know shit and Hollywood mm-hmm. is kind of bullshit, right? Like mm-hmm. that's, I feel like that's the subtext to what he's saying. Mm-hmm. I feel like you have to read into it a lot because you're listening to Orson Welles speak.
Yeah.
And obviously he's not talking about, you know, his personal experience won't be fine art, you know? Well, I mean, I guess in a sense, like, he did do paintings, which I did not know, but mm-hmm. like, that's, you know, that's so far removed. His main calling was filmmaking, right? And especially you're saying, like, he was, you know, at that time trying to make a ton of indie films, right? Like, he was just going,
he couldn't get financing. A lot of his movies, right? He ran out of money and it just stopped.
So it makes sense that he would be the kind of guy, at especially at that time, who would just be making these statements of, you know, do these people even really understand what art is? Like, who decides what's good, right? Like, because, you know, mm-hmm. I'm trying to make this stuff and I see it as having value, but, you know, what, somebody decides that, oh, Citizen Kane is the one of the greatest achievements and that's why, you know, but I think this film I've been making is also great, just like that, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I think he's trying to, I feel like, at least when while I was watching it, I kept thinking about that. I kept thinking mm-hmm. that this was kind of more his story than mm-hmm. anything else, right? It was more, like, he talks a lot about, obviously, the whole actual documentary, but I feel like his narration makes it a lot more about, a lot more personal to him than it does mm-hmm. their story. It's just the kind of, I don't know, it's kind of the feeling I got throughout.
Mm-hmm. No, at the time, you're absolutely right, because, again, this paralleled with The Other Side of the Wind, which...
Yeah.
I haven't seen it yet, but what I do know about it is that it's a kind of like a film within a film about a director's last day alive.
Mm. Okay.
And a lot of it parallels Orson himself. Even though he's not in the film and he'll deny this isn't about me, everyone with the making of it and the actors like, oh, this is about you.
Yeah.
And a lot of his earlier films, a lot of his films in general that he wrote and directed, have a lot of him in it.
Yeah, that's the thing. Mm-hmm. Noticed that, and it feels like this had quite a bit of that, and especially you say you give me that context of that he came in late and worked on the film, like he took over the film,
right? Yeah,
which is interesting because you can see that if you take him out of it, there's just that first, like, say the first hour, but you take out his narration and everything, it's a straight documentary.
Mm-hmm.
But then he comes in and he changes the whole thing and makes it a lot and adds a lot more of obviously himself literally by coming in and narrating, mm-hmm. but also his influence. I feel like it's a lot of that he brought in. If you take him out, it is about fine art. You bring him in, it starts to become a lot about him and a lot more about film.
Mm-hmm.
So I look at this more, for me personally, as a movie about a movie about film for me.
Mm-hmm.
At least my interpretation of it, or at least the way I was listening to Orson, the way he was narrating it.
Yeah, and you're absolutely, to give it a little bit more context in terms of, like, him being bitter and all that, he has a lot to be bitter about, because a lot of his films after Citizen Kane, because the thing about Citizen Kane, even though we you know, herald it as one of the greatest films ever made, mm-hmm. at the time it was actually booed at the Oscars.
Yeah, I heard that.
Because of the newspaper tycoon who was the main, you know, inspiration for the character. William Randolph Hearst basically did a smear campaign against both Orson and the film, kind of like already kind of butchering his reputation. And then his second film, The Magnificent Ambersons, he had directed it, finished it, and then he went to South America to start working on another film. But while he was there, the studio, who did not like how the movie was ending, went behind Welles' back and reshot and redid the ending.
Oh.
And Welles was not happy about that.
Yeah.
And that, unfortunately, that original ending is lost. It's gone.
And another thing on top of that is, which is more famous, is his dealings with the making of Touch of Evil, where he was hired to direct it, but once again, the studio did not like how it was coming about, and they re-edited the whole film without Welles' approval. And then Welles famously wrote a 54-page memo to the studio saying, this is what you can do with the movie to make it better. But they discarded it and completely ignored it and released it as a 90-minute B-movie on a double bill. It wasn't until years later that the Welles estate decided to use the memo as a blueprint to re-edit the film how Orson wanted it. Yeah. And that's the film actually we all kind of see right now. It's the only one really out there. It's the one I own.
You have a write-up of that memo too, don't you?
I do. I have that memo. It came with the DVD, and it's cool to read because you're like, I'm reading the legit words of somebody like explaining why this edit should be like this. You shouldn't have any music here because I wanted to hear the world and the border town and all that to flood. And this is not a title credit sequence here, and just a bunch of stuff. And he's been, and again, like struggling to find money to finance his projects. You know, he became you can see like certain projects, you look at the makeup, either if it looks good he had more money, if it looks shittier he had less money. And some films took like 6 years to finish because he only had funding to do it for a certain amount of time, then he had to go act in another movie or do a wine commercial to fund his movies. He did a lot of wine commercials.
Oh, those commercials are glorious. Mm-hmm. Especially like the takes, like the B-roll and stuff. Hilarious.
I know.
He just wasted.
Yeah, just
like,
just completely. It's like,
So you know it's good wine then.
He was the guy who goes to wine tastings and fucking drinks the wine.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then
you're not supposed to drink this.
Yeah, he's like Dr. Steve Rule. He's like Dr. Steve Rule.
Yeah.
For your wine.
Wait, you're not supposed to supposed to drink wine at a wine tasting?
You spit it out.
You spit it out.
But why?
Steve Rule don't get drunk.
Are you being facetious?
I don't drink wine or much at all.
Wine drinking. There's a guy with a fucking bucket walking around. You should.
You would be fucking throwing up by the end of it.
Yeah. It's tasting it. That's all.
That's weird.
It's wine tasting.
All right. Because if you were drinking all that wine, everybody there would be throwing up by the end of the night.
Yeah. For like a sip.
You're drinking. But you're doing
takes.
Wine.
You're doing takes.
Yeah. Because a wine tasting is like
so many shots.
A lot of different wine.
Yeah. Even like the wine, actually fine, we're talking about wine, there's also a thing about the whole like, you know, wine experts saying this is good wine, this is bad wine,
and I've heard that's a load of shit too, because like some like the cheapest bottles of wine get like super highly praised.
And then like I've seen video where like
that's why in France wine isn't expensive.
Well, they buy it daily.
It's all good. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's
like,
all good. Yeah.
Well, everything there is like good. It's not.
Well, for France, the soil is perfect for it. Mm-hmm. So like, yeah, it's gonna be good.
So you go to like a regular
import
super
fees.
Grocer for your wine there. Yeah, just everybody does that. So anyway,
for you wine.
Yeah, I'm also not a wine snob of any kind. I don't even
Andrew the wine
I barely
snob.
Drink. Wine. Like I don't know.
Andrew will tell you about the good wine.
I like my grapes as grapes.
Oh, Andrew, I've seen you stomping grapes. You say you're not a wine expert, I say you are.
My only experience with stomping grapes is that YouTube video where that old lady falls over.
It's pretty good.
Oh my god.
Classics.
We're laughing at someone's pain.
It's hilarious.
It is, but it isn't. Have you ever fallen like that before?
She's old too.
Oh, I know.
She's old too. Like, she could have seriously messed herself up.
She could have broken
her collarbone. But it's hilarious.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
We're all such pieces of shit.
She was into...
We're sympathetic, but also appreciative of the humor.
Honestly, I'm just going to say this. After this movie, I was exhausted. So half the time I've been talking out of my ass, and I'm just...
You've been faking it.
Deliriously laughing and shit now. So, yes.
She just have a snare and a hi-hat so you can just do
I just want it at my disposal.
Yeah, I can't...
I got one
endless
for you.
Rim shots.
We'll have some weird echoey sound effect, and then the follow-up will be Zach pun.
Oh,
off
the intro.
No, I like that. It'll follow the pun.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So you're like you're just like confirming.
Yeah, it's kind of like with the
Batman. It's like a trademark stamp.
Yeah, it's like the period.
It's like the Batman TV series when he punches the guy, you see the pow on the screen.
Yeah, yeah.
It would be stupid to have that on the screen before the punch.
Or something, you know?
Yeah.
We just need a good sound.
We just need a good soundboard, I think, is what we've established.
Oh, yeah.
Soundboard.
At one point, we'll have one, yeah. And it will add a whole new layer to this show.
So more about Exit Through the Gift Shop. Not a whole lot, because Andrew mentioned it. I forgot to mention it. I was planning on it. Forgot about it. Glad he mentioned it earlier. But Exit Through the Gift Shop, it's not about forgery, but it is about the same thing about what is art.
Sorry, not forgery, yeah.
Yeah, it's not about forgery. Times. Well, I don't know if you said it, but I'm just saying it's not about forgery per se, but it's about what is art exactly. And it pretty much, like, there's Banksy in there and things like that. He's kind of like,
like a phony, doing his
thing, but then there's this guy who's like a complete idiot. Clearly shows that like throughout the movie that this guy's kind of dumb, but he does some art pieces and he becomes like super successful.
Yeah.
And then I think there's someone else who actually is like more educated and things like that, and he kind of struggles and things like that. And it's kind of showing more of like, oh, if you're an idiot, but like, what is art kind of thing? Even though this person seems pretty dumb and things, mm-hmm. like, you know, they make something. People are like, oh my god. And, you know, well, is that really art, or is that just, like, a work of a buffoon? And, you know, and it's pretty much that's what it is. That's kind of in a quick summary of what that is.
Yeah.
And then Banksy's kind of talking about, like, the whole thing, too. And there's obviously his works, which are super famous.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. But it's really fascinating. It would be kind of an interesting companion with this, even though it's super different. Like, with this film, with the editing style and everything, it's just so... you've never seen anything like this ever. Like, I haven't. Just with the style of the editing and the shots.
Yeah.
Where he decides to, like, freeze frame and, like, his narration.
Well, the freeze frames is kind of out of its time. Like, the 70s loved them freeze frames.
Well, yeah, sure. But it's really nice, because you can say that, too. It's of the time, but there is also just his style, like, for this movie that he just kind of came up with. And the whole format, if you will, is just super fascinating on its own.
Yeah. And actually, just going to give a little some background in terms of what happened after to these certain individuals, particularly with Elmir. He was actually, it was kind of alluded to that he did spend a little bit of time in prison, but they didn't mention what it was for. And he actually spent time in prison for homosexuality and consorting with criminals. And then, unfortunately... Elmir would commit suicide 2 years after the release of F for Fake upon hearing Spain had agreed to turn him over to French authorities. Knowing that and just kind of like it does kind of put like a but at the same time he was a guy always on the run, like constantly, like his like it's almost like a catch me if you can
type of
plot, especially when he's in America just going all over the place, you know, escape going from Mexico to Canada and back to New York and then got to take a bus here. And, you know, my own drawings would sell for $5, but if I were to do this, it would sell for how much? And just even the figures, this is in 1972 and they're mentioning like $8,000 to $10,000 in today's money. That is, you know,
a lot,
like almost that's going on close to like almost $100,000 in today's money. It's insane. And I'm with you, Andrew. I sometimes just go, spend that much money on a piece of paper. It's amazing. Yeah. And when you really, like, be objective. But then again, the whole thing, question of, like, what is art is the most subjective question
anyone could ask.
There's no right answer. Everyone has their opinion.
And it goes down to so many variables. There's even the whole, like, if you want to get into it, there's the whole subjective, objective argument in art itself, like what is art in that side?
Yeah, right? Having an objective opinion on a film. It's like, is there really a such thing? There's not like, okay, this
maybe
is how
on the technical aspect.
On a technical, like that's how like certain things, like I can differentiate like what I think is the greatest film compared to what's my favorite film. You know, there's my favorite team's the Canucks, but they're not the best hockey team in the world, not even close.
Nope.
So, and it's the same thing. My favorite movie is this, but I think this is the greatest movie of all time. And, you know, my favorite art piece is music is this, but is it like, you know, it should be studied and, you know, done essays about? don't know.
My favorite poop was this one, but the best poop was this one.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Like, any, honestly, it's just, like, even as stupid as that, it's subjective.
Yeah, exactly.
It's, and to me, that's what's great about art. It can be anything. There's no right answer, and it's what you take from it. And that's, again, that's why I think why this movie is very fascinating. It mm-hmm. presents itself as one thing, but then it just... Again, it's a lot to take in, and then, you know, you're with one story, and then, you know, I was more like, because this is my third time watching, I was more interested in anything that was more focused on Wells.
Yeah.
I was more, of course, when I first saw the movie, I was really into the art, because that's what they start you with. So, of course, that's what you follow, and you think that's the main narrative. But then as the movie goes along, it takes you completely different places, and then it fucks with you at the end, and... I love all the you know, Orson loves his magic, and you know he's a bit semi-professional magician, so he
the whole thing is like a magic trick, like the whole movie, which I think is really dope.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he starts at the very beginning of the movie, he's doing magic tricks, and then like by the end it's like, oh yeah, by the way,
yeah,
and it's just really, really, really cool. I remember that, and like, and the funny thing is like, I find a lot of people, like, at least from hearing from us and my own experiences, like when he says at the beginning, you kind of like, okay, that's going to be important. But then you forget about it because you're so hypnotized with all these different stories and his narration and the visual presentation
mm-hmm.
and like the editing styles and things like that, that by the time you get to that point at the end, you've already forgotten about it.
Yeah. And enough can't be said about, if you had to take one thing in terms of the craftsmanship of this movie, if you want to be a little, again, objective.
Yes.
It's the editing.
Oh, absolutely.
The editing in this room, it will stand the test of time mm-hmm. in terms of an example of just, you know, taking things that may not have no connection whatsoever
and making them work,
and make not only making it work, but making it profound, making it engaging, and asking so many different questions, and not just, you know, a straight documentary. We've seen that
mm-hmm.
but I feel like this you know, this type of film and this way of editing has influenced standard documentaries. You know, you look at Michael Moore films
mm-hmm.
and how fast those films are cut and how they go back and forth to different, you know, drop one story and then come back to it
mm-hmm.
and all stuff. There's a lot of that in documentaries today, which I think, you know, F for Fake was probably one of the first, at least one of the earliest, most famous films to do that. I don't think it's like, say, the first true film essay. There's probably a bunch before
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
but it's definitely the first that people in terms of that people remember.
Right, but even his shots and stuff too, like, kind of stand out. Like, he'll be doing narration, like, but it's not like typical narration. Like, he's actually speaking in front of the camera
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that. And he'll have like just friends around and stuff, and it's just it's very casual. And it's like, again, that's something else that sets it apart from a lot of other films.
Take this. Can you please take this?
He's like having a meal, but he's like doing narrating and stuff. And there's like people around. He's just in a restaurant. Like, it's kind of like everywhere. It's just so different, but it's so cool. And again, even just that itself is interesting, and the changing of locations and all that. It's just all fascinating.
And like I said, like for a lot of people and for anyone, it could fall apart very quickly and become a huge mess.
Yeah.
What's the point? Where is this going?
Yeah.
And then yet, even at times you're just like, I don't know where this is kind of going, but yet I want to know.
Yeah.
I just, again, it's the whole thing about, you know, the magician, you want to... And like The Prestige even brings up, you don't really want to know, and it's a human instinct to wanting to like, I gotta peek behind the curtain, I gotta know what's happening, I gotta know where this is going, especially with someone like Orson, who is just a master magician, master performer, you mm-hmm. know, a way of just drawing you in, and you know, he'll hold your hand, but then he might let you go and you're alone in the fog, but you just hear his voice.
Mm-hmm.
And you just kind of have to figure it out from there. And they even like, visualize that at the end. I love the sequence of him and Oya just kind of playing off each other.
Yeah,
like sometimes he's a narrator, and then he's pretending to be his dad, and then he's Picasso, and then he's just kind of like, again, in a trance.
And I love the use of photos as well in that Picasso section, where he's like peeking out the window and they kind of make it look like he's looking out and stuff, and it's just like, oh, it's just, it's so creative, like it's so good.
And all of anything with Oya was definitely like a this isn't really original, but it's more of a obviously a play on the male gaze.
Oh, of course.
And they even plan to say it in the beginning,
yeah,
but because it's always kind of like, in the beginning, you're like, why are we just seeing a bunch of guys just staring
at
this?
Ass.
Yeah, staring at this moment.
Yeah.
And she's actually in the other side of the wind as well, plays another role.
That makes sense around that time, yeah.
Yeah, basically, like, she was, I think it was, like, her muse, in a sense.
Yeah.
Would, like, help him with the projects, write it, film it, and star in it as well. And, I think this was, like, their first official, like, credited project
well,
working together.
Well, yeah, he said introduce at the
top.
Oh, yeah, it did, yeah.
Yeah.
And then he would
Kodar.
Later...
Kodar.
Yeah.
And he would later help out with the Star Wars.
Yeah, he did the trailer.
Yeah, or some else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, as we were talking, his that was his last completed film, and he would die like a decade later.
Yeah.
So, and during that whole time, he was trying to get more projects made, but...
Oh, yeah, he was always trying to make movies.
Always trying, and then he would still do, you know, voice acting and
yep.
bit parts here and there. Of
wine
course,
commercials.
Wine commercials and among other things.
Well, you have to live.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
And he was moving all over the place. He was known to travel with a camera and an editing bay everywhere he went. Like, and he was every hotel, everywhere he just had a camera so that if he saw something, he could bring it out and film it, like, immediately. So again, like, he was kind of like, again, one of the first, like, independent filmmakers.
He really was.
Yeah.
Like, even was from Citizen Kane and that.
Yeah,
like
for in terms of, like, guerrilla filmmaking,
yep.
going out there and getting the shot and, you know, just constantly doing it for the love of it.
And way ahead of his time in that regard.
Very
much. I mean, because that was in an era where it was just, like, all studio based and all like
mm-hmm.
just that right, you're in the machine and you're pumping out these
and even
movies.
The Hollywood system was changing around that time between
yeah.
the 60s and 70s from the old guard to the new, you know, corporations taking over the studios
yeah.
and then of course the rise of the blockbusters
mm.
you know, the B movies becoming the money makers and the old
yeah.
dramas and the old ways of star building was dying
yeah.
and of course unfortunately Wells was part of that
yeah.
that core but yeah no I think we've kind of covered a lot of ground with this movie. Mm. I think we're about ready to wrap this one up. Alex, do you have anything more you'd like to add to this?
Yeah, aside from the fact that I do think it's underrated.
Mm.
Knowing the pantheon of Wells films, this should probably be up there a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think one unintended consequence of watching this film is... And I don't know if he intended this, but because of his disdain for how the studios had treated him in the past with his films, like recutting and so on,
mm-hmm.
I think he unintentionally made the audience sharper and smarter, made the audience question what they're watching.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is art? The integrity of it. Does this have any merit whatsoever? Like, with... Even with people watching news nowadays, the thing is we're supposed to believe what we hear on the news. No, there's a lot of people out there who will take every single, not only sentence of what a newscaster will tell you, but every single word. Why are you using that word?
Mm-hmm.
What's the purpose of this phrase? Why did you look that way? People have become so critical of absolutely everything. And we've brought this up in past shows
mm-hmm.
that... It's hard to just sit down and watch a movie without, or anything for that matter. Music, movies, art. It's hard to just sit down and enjoy it for what it is sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Because is there an intention behind it?
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in a small town where people would spread rumors about each other. And it got to the point with me where I was so frustrated. Someone would say, well, I heard this. And I would immediately jump in. Who did you hear it from? When? What else was said? Do you have any evidence to back up your claim? Do you have any proof whatsoever that what you're saying is true, or are you just simply believing it on faith? Because I was so sick of what I was hearing and the fact that it was obviously not true, and I would see the blowback from those rumors in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see that nowadays with people being so critical of not only media, but of what politicians say.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that politicians say, no one... Well, not no one. That's a blanket statement. I like to keep myself warm at night when I say no. Everything that a lot of people say, a lot of people do not believe it because we've been sold the snake oil before. There have been so many con men from Joseph Smith
mm-hmm.
onward and even further back from them that people who have experienced that and read about that nowadays, they're so sick of it. Mm-hmm. They have no idea what to believe. I have no idea what to believe. I don't know what's true.
Mm-hmm.
Read a news story. Well, what perspective is that coming from? Is there an intention that they're trying to give us by telling the story in that particular way?
Yeah, and in a sense, it kind of like, it's both a blessing and of a curse. You know, you want to be skeptical, but then of a lot of things, because you know you don't want to believe something at just face value because it might come back and bite you in the ass. But the same thing we said about being skeptical of everything is that then you don't believe anything, and then everything becomes a conspiracy. You know, we see that today with people with conspiracy theories.
Yeah,
you know, believing just something and without any evidence, or they find just a small kernel of like, oh, there's something here, and then we're used to seeing patterns, and then when something fits a pattern, we think that's how it actually went, when it could be something completely different.
Yes,
you know. And yeah, it is kind of like parallels with your argument, Zach, about how, you know, at least movie audiences today, at least the hardcore ones, everyone thinks they are an expert.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
you know, they'll nitpick films to death. They'll think they know what they're talking about, you know. But even us saying that is like, it comes off as an expert.
Sounds like you're the expert.
I know, exactly. It's
all subjective.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that's really all it should be. And I think, again, it's like people are kind of, you know, shooting themselves in their own foot without, mm-hmm. you know, just saying, hey, it's art. It's just, or, you know, there, you got to find that balance. It's, you know, yeah. So if you had anything else to add in terms of, yeah, no, I will say, you say it's underrated. I think in terms of his film library, I think it is, like, because it's unlike anything he's made. It's not it doesn't have really a plot. It's not a scripted movie at any sense. Well, maybe in some parts it is, but it's not. It's so out there. It's ahead of its time, because you mm-hmm. basically you can watch these type of essays on YouTube, just on any topic nowadays, and there are really good ones out there, and they all kind of owe a debt to this film.
Yeah,
I believe. So yeah, anything else you want to add?
Yeah, that's the great thing about an essay, because he had what, 30 or 40 years of film knowledge to mm-hmm. draw upon and experience that he could tell the audience, hey, this is what I think about this. He gives you a theme, he can branch off at some point, he can bring in people he thinks are interesting, and voila, you get a film like this, which, great, maybe this is the real Wells that we'll see only once in mm-hmm. this film.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, great. And if you want to see another great film, stay tuned for 2020, Zach's film, Rootin' Tootin' Booty.
Rootin' Tootin' Hootin' Booty.
There you go.
It'll be the real Zach.
Oh, yeah. It'll be filmed just like this, and just like this, and you'll have six different booty stories to cut between, and
as long as one.
Well, which one's fake? What's the fake booty? And what booty are we talking about?
We should all
maybe the man's name is Booty,
ooh.
And maybe that's what it is.
Can you imagine
a guy just being named Booty? What terrible parents! That would be a good story though. It'd be like,
are you thinking of names
the
for your
life.
Offspring?
I think you're onto something,
right? And that's just one. That's one story. I thought more.
And that's not bullshit. I actually do think you're onto something.
There you go.
Man, that's actually not bad.
Yeah, Booty.
In this day and age, that has probably already happened.
My name is Booty, and I hate it. I hate my parents. I want to sue my parents.
Yeah,
I'm sure there's a Maury episode.
Yeah, you're watching too much Maury and Springer.
They don't even touch that. They're just still on the "you are the father, you're not the father."
Well, Springer's gone now, isn't it?
Yeah, he is. I'm talking more Maury.
Yeah,
Maury's
still on.
And here comes the pineapples. I love those too. But anyways, Andrew,
maybe that's more Dr. Phil.
No, that's
oh, no.
They bring out the fruits. What are you scared of?
I'm suing my parents and
okay.
That's more a Dr. Phil thing.
That's true.
Yeah,
actually,
that is
Dr.
Fair point.
Dr.
Yeah.
Phil kind of goes into that territory nowadays.
Dr. Phil, though, I will say on a sidebar here, Dr. Phil, man, he knows how to slam it down. when he just wants to destroy someone, he's really great at that,
yeah,
actually.
He's savage.
Yeah.
What the hell are you talking about?
That was okay. That was good. I was debating whether to go for it. I was like, nah.
Oh, he's got some savage slam downs.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like him for that. But anyways.
Mr. Shuck, any final thoughts?
Yeah. Yes. I might be tired, so I have...
Yes!
So I ha- yes.
It's past my bedtime, too. It's okay.
You left at the word simpatico for some reason.
What?
Yeah, it, they said that they're the Chinese word simpatico, and I heard you. You're like, pfft. You remember that? Sorry, I'm jumping in.
That when I like chuckled at that?
Yeah, because you don't know that's not a Chinese word, I guess.
Simpatico?
Yeah. I don't know.
How it's fucking, yeah, like, it's just so ridiculous to me. He's just like, okay. The Chinese, it was just such a, it was just such a, like, off-the-cuff comment that, like, didn't mean anything. It was like, you know, the Chinese word simpatico is like, what the fuck are you saying? Like, I had no idea. I was like, did you write that? Like, why? Like, were you just trying to see if people would catch that? Like, I don't, like, what fucking Chinese word?
Exactly.
First of all, Chinese word, Chinese isn't a dialect anyways. Like, that's a weird thing to say in general. Like, that's, you know, somebody's talking out of their ass when they say the Chinese word, blah, blah, blah. Because it's like, well, what fucking Chinese dialect are you referring to?
The first thing you should say when
or is
you
it a
home.
Dialect or are you talking Chinese characters? What are we fucking talking about here? So whenever somebody says, a white person says that, I'm like, pfft. Right? And then it was like simpatico. I'm like, I don't know, it was just absurd. So I laughed at it.
All right.
The first thing you should say to Denise when you go home, the Chinese word.
I'm going to.
Actually.
I have like,
see what
my,
her reaction
my wife is.
Is
Chinese.
It's
going to
be the biggest
Cantonese.
Slap you've ever seen.
So, you know, sure, I'm going to say that. Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. No, I am tired, so I will say something controversial because I'm tired. I like this film more than Citizen Kane. Actually,
okay,
wow,
personally,
nice. Well, ain't that a review?
No, that's cool. I like that.
There you go. Me better than Citizen Kane,
yeah. You,
as quoted by Andrew,
put that on a
podcast,
put it
Andrew.
On the box, yeah.
Yeah. Quoted by
that's
Andrew,
right. Andrew. Yeah. Better than Citizen Kane.
Can we, can we get that on date? That's good shit.
Yeah, yeah. I enjoyed personally enjoyed this more than I enjoyed watching Citizen Kane just because I had that. Citizen Kane was for me overrated, and I had that built up so much, and I didn't realize going into it that it was going to be a film that was just all about just going to be technically ahead of its time. But when it came to the actual enjoyment and substance of it, it wasn't going to be anything like as extraordinary as Best Ever,
right?
Subjectively for
right.
me. In terms of enjoyment,
this is why
I can think like objectively. You look at it and be like, for a film for its time period, it's amazing. Like, it is really cool to look at and be like, when was this made? Like, that's crazy to think it was made that it was made during its time period that it was made, just because it holds up remarkably. It's like a Kurosawa film in that regard,
right?
Where you're like, wow, this is way ahead of its time. So I dig that part of it, but then in terms of just my own personal enjoyment, which is typically why I watch film, because I'm not, you know, I'm not a film student. It's an escape, you know. Like, it doesn't need to be like popcorn to escape. I can like watch something uncomfortable and enjoy it.
There's got to be some,
you know,
sort of
it's just
gotta
it's gotta provoke some kind of emotion,
right?
So
like
that's
for the
film,
Iron Man.
That just fucking, I don't know, whatever. Yeah. Confusion? I don't know. Anyway.
You weren't going with Inside or Martyrs?
No.
Like Inside because it made me uncomfortable, but I just don't want to watch it.
That's
again.
Like an example that you would agree with. That's the thing I wasn't going for.
Yeah,
I was going to go with smart
like,
ass.
I don't know, whatever. Like, yeah, it wasn't a positive emotion. I don't know. But, because
you were uncomfortable during that movie, though. So
I wasn't having fun, but, which I guess isn't the point, but I wasn't even, like, I don't know, I wasn't getting anything out of it, personally.
But here's the question, though. Is Citizen Kane and Tetsuo the Iron Man art? That's the big question.
I guess.
Is it art?
Well, like, Citizen Kane is more obviously art, but...
What do you mean? What does that mean? Maybe that's up to you. Maybe you're not the
expert.
I don't
know, just...
Or are you?
Maybe you should watch them back to back and like
No, side by side.
Side by side.
Citizen Tetsuo. we'll just edit both movies.
Oh, man. I watched the hell out of that.
Kane the Iron Man. I like that, too.
A media mogul who becomes a machine.
Yeah, perfect.
Well, anyway, Tetsuo. Point being, I didn't have as much personal enjoyment while watching Citizen Kane, just like from a storytelling perspective. I was like, this is the best movie ever. Okay, like I guess I shouldn't have come into it like this because obviously I was gonna be underwhelmed. Because like with Kurosawa, I didn't come in with that expectation, right? When I watched like I always fucking do this.
Which one? He's like
making movies. No, the first Kurosawa movie I saw.
Was it Seven Samurai?
Seven Samurai. Yeah, when I went into Seven Samurai, I wasn't expecting like, oh, this is the best movie ever. I just
really
I didn't know what to expect.
You know that that's like a lot of people's favorite movie.
But it wasn't probably hyped up.
I just knew that Kurosawa was you know like very well regarded.
Yeah, like I can relate with that because Citizen Kane, its tagline
is the greatest.
I kept getting beat over the head with this and trying to watch it for so many years. And I, like, just never, for whatever reason, just didn't get to it.
Yeah.
And then I finally did, and I was like, well, that was underwhelming. Mm-hmm. But, like, it is a technical masterpiece. Like, I'll say, like, technically, damn, that was good. But as a movie, like, it's underwhelming to be told that something's the best ever, and then to be like, I didn't think, that's not my favorite movie. Mm-hmm. Not even close to my favorite movie.
Yeah.
Which is a bummer.
I mean,
so, whereas I saw this, and I got a lot more out of this film. To be honest, like from a storytelling perspective and just being interested in the behind the scenes as well as what was happening on, like, knowing the story behind it and what was happening throughout, I was compelled, I was interested, I was trying to piece things together. It was just a more interesting experience for me. I enjoyed this more, and I haven't seen a lot of Orson Welles.
You've seen his first and his last.
Yeah.
You just got to see all the shit in the middle now.
So, like, I don't really have much to draw on. So, best Orson Welles film for me right now.
So far.
There you go. Underrated, clearly.
I mean, yeah, and going back to just what we were talking about before, like, yeah, Citizen Kane is the extreme of, like, best movie ever. Like, that was always the thing attached to it. But I'm so shocked that you didn't hear about Seven Samurai also being considered one of the best movies ever,
because
that's usually what people call it.
Because it's a foreign film.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, it does.
A lot of people that I know, even in film school.
Well, I knew about.
Yeah, but that's in film school.
No, I guess some of that too.
No. You're both right. At the same time, I've always had heard Seven Samurai being like the pinnacle of Japanese cinema.
Mm-hmm.
But even
beyond that, Jack, like a lot of people even just consider it like a masterpiece. If you're a cinematographer, it's the greatest film ever.
No. But again, that is a little bit more like in the dirt of being a filmmaker.
Yeah.
But in terms of what you marketed the film as
Citizen Kane
for like 50 years has been marketed as the greatest film
that's
ever
true,
made.
Yeah.
Whereas Seven Samurai has always been considered like one of the greatest Japanese films of all time, and also like one of the more influential films in terms of its storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
You see it in like The Magnificent Seven and A Bug's Life and all that. It had a profound effect, ripple effect on American storytelling and worldwide storytelling in the future of cinema.
Yeah.
So I think you both are sort of right in a sense. Those who are not like, say, the more casual or more not in the nitty gritty about. Mm-hmm. You know, I was more fascinated seeing Kurosawa.
Yeah.
I was like, who is this Kurosawa and why is this film so lauded?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I didn't even see Samurai first. I saw Rashomon first.
Well, yeah. And I mean, in other films, that's fine. But Seven Samurai particularly, like Citizen Kane, you're obviously going to hear about his best film ever. But I'm just surprised you also didn't hear that for Seven Samurai. But like, oh yeah, it's one of the greatest films of all time.
I didn't.
That's surprising because it is regarded like as
I know, but it's regarded, but I didn't, it wasn't like, again,
it's not even my favorite Kurosawa film.
Yeah, but is it
it's the same thing as The Exorcist. It's considered the scariest movie of all time.
Yeah,
that's his tagline.
Wow.
It's not,
no, but, well, that's,
but,
a whole
but
lot
that's
of
what it's sold as, so that when everyone hears The Exorcist, it's usually followed by, oh, that's, everyone says that's the scariest movie
maybe
of
the
all
Exorcist
time.
For me then was like for my Citizen Kane, because like I heard it's like, oh, it's like this scary movie, and I'm just like, I was fucking bored to tears watching.
I haven't seen The Exorcist.
Yeah, I know, but
I don't
I
think
say,
you're missing anything.
Yeah, no. We'll tell you, but we'll tell you though that I mean, the, like we've talked about The Exorcist before, but I mean, it's a little overrated in that regard. Like, it's a good movie. I like it more than she does, for sure.
I've seen
it's
The Exorcism
good.
Of Emily Rose.
I kind of like that movie. The actress, I forget her name, the girl who's playing Emily
Jennifer
Rose.
Jennifer Carpenter?
Yeah, that's her. Amazing in that movie. Like, she actually does the whole bending and stuff, eh? Like, that actually
oh,
was
gross.
Her. Yeah.
All
right. So, pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I was already gross on screen.
Tom Hilkinson's
cool.
good in it, too.
That's
like, it's
gross.
Actually a pretty good movie if you're kind of, like, down to see a...
Yeah.
Or, but anyways, we're going way off track.
but yeah, I think it makes a big difference if it is from Japan, just because if you're talking about something that is part of the cultural zeitgeist, right? Something that
mm-hmm.
is in the fucking Simpsons mm-hmm. and stuff like that. Like, I know Seven Samurai's influence
mm-hmm.
is Seven Samurai is like has influenced a lot of other things that have come after it
mm-hmm.
a lot, but that's not readily apparent because people don't talk about that as much. Like, you'll see in behind the
yeah.
scenes, but most people are, unless you're seeking it out, don't
mm-hmm.
really see that. You know, whereas Citizen Kane, people literally say Citizen Kane and mention the name,
mm.
the title of the film, and
mm-hmm.
Orson Welles, and all of that comes up in like in episodes of The Simpsons
or
in whatever. That shit literally comes up in regular because it's like an American film, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a Hollywood film. Whereas like Seven Samurai, it's more like these directors use this film as inspiration. But then it in a lot of cases, you're not hearing, oh, Seven Samurai from Akira Kurosawa, right? It's
mm-hmm.
like you never really hear that or see that anywhere.
It's not
unless
marketed
you seek it
that
out.
Way.
It's not. I
not in the
that,
mainstream.
Yeah.
But I'm
is
surprised you didn't hear that from anybody.
Citizen Kane is definitely in the mainstream.
Yes,
like,
I know that. Yeah.
Whereas Seven Samurai, not so much.
Well, that's just because it's like a foreign film, I
guess. Exactly, that's the point
I'm
making.
But I'm surprised that as soon as you heard about Kurosawa and Seven Samurai, you didn't hear about like, oh yeah, it's one of the greatest films ever.
Well, no, after you hear about it, I'm talking about in the what Andrew's like on is just the popular zeitgeist. I go up to my mom, I'm like, hey, Seven Samurai, okay? It's a
yeah,
Japanese
yeah,
yeah.
movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Citizen Kane. Oh, that's what they say is the greatest film of all time.
Exactly.
Fucking Friends has a joke where they're like, Joey's like, I just saw Citizen Kane. Oh, that's supposed to be the greatest movie. Yeah. It was so boring. Like, but it's supposed to be a big deal. I know. And I had to watch it. But why? And, you know,
yeah.
and then The Simpsons, you could cut basically all the references
yeah.
and watch the entire
like
movie.
The film.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Someone's must have done that.
I'm sure.
Right?
I've watched.
I'm sure it's on like YouTube or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not like the entire 2.5 hour movie. It's more like an hour.
Oh wow!
But
I think Topher Grace is close to doing.
Yeah,
he's
Grace on it. Topher. Eddie Brock.
But yeah, man. I don't know. Like for me, it makes sense that I knew about Citizen Kane.
Mm.
Seven Samurai was more something that just came up later.
Mm.
And I think that makes a big difference.
Same here.
I think that makes a really big difference. If you hear about it and you watch it in close proximity, then you don't have as much to go on.
I guess
right?
that's a
where,
big difference
whereas
too,
with
yeah.
Citizen Kane, I had like so many years
well, there was
of
build
prep
up.
And build up for
yeah,
that.
You're welcome.
That no fucking movie ever could have lived up to that
you're
expectation.
You're welcome.
No movie.
You
like,
got
I,
trolled.
Dude, I yeah, exactly. You could have made fucking my favorite movie, and it still wouldn't have lived up to that shit. Just because, like,
yeah.
what's a crazier buildup than it's the best movie ever made? It's a class.
And
it's
Andrew begged me
in
for
everything.
Years.
Well, you're going into
it
with, like, show me.
Yeah.
Yes. Like, I have, you've set the expectation for yourself. Like, you've set that expectation for yourself. You set it
for years.
An impossible
yeah.
watermark.
I will,
standard.
Yeah. I will say, just from my own personal experience, you can take it or leave it, Andrew. It is one of those films that when you first watch it, it has that expectation. Once you get that out of the way and you watch it for like a second time, all of a sudden you don't have that burden on you anymore. You can kind of see it more for what it is. You may, and for me personally, I got more into it. And
yeah.
I can definitely say it's one of my favorite films now, not
mm-hmm.
from the first viewing. It took a few for me to really appreciate. Now I'm really into the story. I really
yeah.
love the characters. I love the moments on top of the craftsmanship on top of it. So it's one of those films that when you get rid of that burden, you kind of appreciate it a bit more for what it is.
Yeah.
Whether or not you still think it's the greatest movie of all time, like, I personally think it's not number one.
Mm-hmm.
For the reasons you just said. Craftsmanship, great. Story, I think there's better.
Yeah.
Me personally, it's The Godfather. I think that just has a better story, and that's why I'm more like, that's great.
Necromantic.
Necromantic.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Zach, final thoughts?
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, we've kind of said a lot about...
Is this the greatest Orson Welles film you've ever seen in your life?
No, but I like it.
What's the greatest Orson Welles film you've ever seen?
It's just fucking Kane, you motherfucker.
Fuck you.
if it had a corpse in it, would it have been better?
Okay, yeah. And would
there
be fake,
is a corpse
be...
instead of Kane. The first 5 minutes, he dies.
No, that for
fake.
Oh, okay.
Except that'd be T for truth, is what that would be. Right there, T for truth.
C for corpse.
Yeah,
C for corpse. C is for corpse.
That would be like if Cookie Monster joined Cannibal Corpse or something.
That's what I just did. That's what I just did.
Oh, I didn't hear you.
I went, yeah. She is for corpse.
No, but I brought in the Cannibal Corpse aspect.
The
band.
The Cookie Corpse.
Oh, so
the Cookie Corpse, yeah.
Yeah.
CC. Keep the same letters. Perfect. I mean, he sounds just like him, too, the lead singer.
That's true.
Yeah.
Cookie Monster vocals. That's what they always call them. Mm-hmm. So that's what my old boss used to call death metal lyrics. Cookie Monster. It's Cookie Monster again.
But then you get into deathcore where it sounds like a pig.
Oh, pig squeals. Yeah,
I don't like that.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. Yeah. It's like, I want to get the moose in. Anyways, we're going off topic.
Yeah, but where does this rank among other Welles films that you have seen?
See, the thing is for me, honestly, with Welles, I haven't really seen a whole lot. I mean, to be fairly honest. I mean, so I would say, like, it's really good. Like, I've seen more of his, like, acting performances reason other people's films.
Right.
I've seen more of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I think this is really good. Like, I think this is, like, probably runner-up to Kane because... But it's so weird to compare them because...
They're so different.
They're even almost, like, different... Yeah, they're different genres, like, completely. And one's, like... Yeah, like you said, like, an essay, but it's, like, a documentary, and it's, like...
Made in 1941, and of, like... And again, like, that film revolutionized American film.
Yeah, and then F for Fake is, like, a magic trick, and it's, like, yeah, documentary, but it's, like, an essay, and it's... Just all sorts of shenanigans, right? And, you know, ahead of its time for editing and blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, yeah, basically if you want a masterclass in, like, a different way of telling a story, or multiple stories, rather, and a masterclass in editing, for sure, I mean, definitely seek this out. It's underrated in a certain regard, because I think anybody who's into, like, this type of cinema should definitely see it, if they're into documentaries, or if they're into just, like, you know, this type of cinema.
And I am, that might have impacted my opinion.
Yeah, probably. But at the same time, like, obviously, general population not going to watch this. I mean, obviously.
Yeah, I don't see my mom.
Yeah, exactly. Like, but underrated for sure,
it's
I would say.
It's probably, it's a tough watch, I would say, for an average person.
Yeah,
you have to, that's what I was saying, you have to be into art house. Like,
that's what I was saying.
Is like, I could, like, right away tell, oh, this is an art house film.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just because I've watched so many.
Yeah.
And, like, you either like it or you don't.
Yeah. If you love cinema, like, people love movies, but if you actually love movies, you love film, I think it's definitely, like, one to seek out,
for
sure.
This is F for fantastic.
Or if you're open-minded, actually. I think, like, more generally speaking, as long as you have an open mind, like, when it comes to film, and you're not, you don't have a specific thing that you like, you're not picky about your films, that you definitely get something out of this, because then and that's the type of person who watches art house films anyway. I don't think it needs to be somebody who's like a film nerd or is knowledgeable when it comes to film. You don't really need that, I think, to appreciate art house film. I think you just have to come in with an open mind.
For sure. And patience.
Yes.
Which is they go hand in hand, I think. Just because you have to also be willing to be open, to be open-minded, you also need to be patient in order to properly process something, or to be, you know, I think it's just naturally how you have to watch these films.
Mm-hmm.
Citizen Kane is Welles' best film, but F for Fake is his sexiest film.
There you go.
F for fucking sexy.
Well, actually of all the Oya scenes.
Yeah. Exactly, right? Yeah. So you see what I mean.
No, yeah.
So not editing's pretty
hot. I don't know, I haven't seen his other films.
The editing's pretty hot.
I guess you get to see a lot.
I have heard of, actually, in The Other Side of the Wind, there are some...
She's good looking, so...
Oh, she's good looking in The Other Side of the Wind, that's for sure.
Yeah, but do you get as many shots of her ass? Really? Oh. Well, damn, I guess we know what Orson was into, so, you know.
Actually, there was a funny gag of someone, like, commenting on F for Fake and that shot where she's running in slow motion with that blue veil.
Yeah. Oh, dude,
the guy was like, we're doing it. Uh-huh. Look at my girlfriend. Just, like, uh-huh. commenting on the film. I was like, that's kind of true.
True.
Yeah.
Rylan.
So I guess one thing, with this movie, you definitely don't have to worry about it being a cookie cutter piece, because there's definitely not anything else like it that I know of. Certainly not for everyone. I'm still not even sure if it was for me, but it's given me a lot to think about. I feel like the questions of art and what does it mean and who decides that and what is it, I feel like I need to decide for myself what that means to me, and maybe then that will allow me to actually have an opinion on the movie and what the rest of it is trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like I wasted my time, but I don't really feel like I conclusively have anything other than just a very occupied brain right now.
I think because you're in that state, I think instead of just kind of gathering thoughts and things like that, I think you should just fake it.
That sounds about right. That's the moral of the story. I suppose. It could very well be the moral of the story, because I think it's alluding to that's kind of what a lot of people are doing anyways.
Yeah.
So just fake it till you make it, and
damn straight. And
until you make it, just keep faking. Also, pretty things are everywhere. Art is arbitrary.
On that note, if you want to listen to this and other great episodes in this being episode 31 of our show, you can find us on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, SoundCloud, Spotify, Instagram at You Missed It or You Missed It Podcast. Thank you for listening today. Next episode, Zach is on cue. Any hints? Anything? Any idea?
Citizen Tetsuo.
No. Citizen Tetsuo. Yeah, I'll have the edit then.
Anything with booty.
Sexy booty.
There's definitely sexual stuff in it. I think I know the movie I'm bringing in, because I've talked to Alex about this for a while now. I think it's going to be that movie, but get ready for an interesting one again.
Oh,
but
Zach always brings the worst movie.
Yeah. and I should also mention at this time that if you want these podcasts translated in Romanian or Spanish, Jack's your guy. So,
sure.
See,
you know, as the Chinese would say,
simpatico.
Simpatico.